Media Masters with Paul Blanchard.
Welcome to Media Masters, a series of one-to-one interviews with people at the top of the media game. Today I'm joined by the journalist, editor and communications director, Peter Barron. Born in Belfast, Peter got his start in journalism as a reporter at the Luxembourg News Digest. He joined the BBC as a trainee in 1988, and after a brief stint as the producer at Newsnight, he moved to ITN, where he was appointed deputy editor of Channel 4 News. He went on to hold the same position at ITV's Tonight with Trevor MacDonald. He returned to the BBC as current affairs editor in 2003, but was quickly promoted to editor of Newsnight, where he introduced several digital initiatives such as the Daily Emails and a vodcast, much scorned by the then lead presenter Jeremy Paxman. The team also won a Royal Television Society award for their coverage of the arms to Iraq scandal. In 2008, he left the BBC to run Google's UK communications and public affairs team. Now in 2015, with a wider remit for Europe, Middle East and Africa, he sets strategy and speaks for the company on subjects such as the right to be forgotten and the impact of Google News on the newspaper industry. Peter, thank you for joining me.
Lovely to be here. Thanks for having me.
So, tell me about the start of your career there. Did you always want to be a journalist? And I must say, I'd never heard of the Luxembourg News Digest. So, how on earth did you end up there?
Well, I wish I could say that it was all sort of mapped out and I wanted to be a journalist from an early age, but I'm not sure I was that well organised. I mean, I was always very interested in news and current affairs when I was a teenager. But actually, it was I didn't have a clear idea of what I wanted to do when I went off to university. And my dad actually said to me, son, there are two things coming up in the 1980s that you should be involved in because, you know, they're going to be big. And one is the City of London, you know, the deregulation of the City of London. So maybe you should study economics. And the other one is Europe and the European community. So you might want to get involved in that. So I wasn't good at figures. So I decided to go down the languages route and I did European studies and modern languages at university.
Was that with a view to going into journalism, or could you have gone into politics?
No, it really wasn't. I didn't have any particular idea of what I wanted to do. But I almost went down the Eurocrat route. I had a very, very narrow escape from that. So basically after university, I went to do a stagiaireship, a sort of internship at the European Parliament. So I was based in Luxembourg, and I went to Luxembourg and Strasbourg and spent a while there. And I was kind of being ever more drawn down the Eurocrat route, but I knew I didn't want to do that. So I left and started working for the Luxembourg News Digest, which I'm not surprised that you've never heard of it. I'm not sure if it's still going.
It's English language.
English language newspaper in Luxembourg. And I remember I was working with a great friend of mine called Paul Ames, and we were sitting down one night. We were both working on the Luxembourg News Digest, and we were having a drink one night and said, well, what are we doing in Luxembourg? Why are we not working in Spain or Portugal, where it's sunny? So we sat down and we literally wrote to every newspaper.
Based in sunny climes.
Yeah, we wrote to every English language newspaper in Spain and Portugal. And lo and behold, a while later, the Algarve News and Algarve magazine wrote back and said, well, we're looking for reporters. So we went off to the Algarve and both got jobs as reporters on the Algarve News.
So that must have been fantastic.
It was absolutely incredible looking back on it, because it was really my first proper job. And when we arrived, there was an editor who edited both the magazine and the newspaper. And after about a month, she went off and had a baby. And I remember the publisher came to us and he said, Paul, I want you to be the editor of the magazine. And Peter, I want you to be the editor of the newspaper. So I was sort of, I can't remember what age I was, but I'd been in the Algarve for about a month, and lo and behold, I was the editor of the Algarve News. It was absolutely fantastic. It was the best job I ever had.
How big was the staff? Was it literally just you and DePaul?
When I went to the BBC to try to be a trainee, I brought a few editions of the Algarve News with me and said, well, this is what I currently do. And they sort of leafed through it and said, so how much of that did you write? And I went, more or less all of it.
All of it,
yes, yeah. It was a very, very small staff. I mean, there was sort of advertising staff and graphics designers and so it was great because The Independent had just... So The Independent launched, I think, in, 1987? Is that right? Maybe I was there in 1987. It was around that time, anyway. But The Independent was a very new thing, and I thought it was a very beautiful newspaper. And the Algarve News wasn't a very beautiful newspaper, and it was also a tabloid. So I basically took a copy of The Independent into the designers, and there's these really great Portuguese graphic designers, and said, look, this is my idea of the kind of beautiful, perfect newspaper. They kind of mocked up a copy of the Algarve News, heavily based upon the London Independent, but it was in tabloid form. So I was kind of years ahead of my time,
and indeed,
I sort of produced a sort of independent lookalike in tabloid form. So we had,
I think
we
the said, phrase is heavily inspired by.
Heavily inspired by it. Homage.
Yeah, that's and even it better,
was,
actually.
It was great. So we said that we had just had the best time. So I was there for about 18 months, and we just did all kinds of stories, timeshare scams, and there was murders and runaway villains. And,
so the audience, for the readership was expats?
It was expats, yeah. So we basically did the newspaper for the expat community in Portugal. It was great job. And then after that, I took in my copies of the Algarve News and presented them to the big cheeses at the BBC, and then I got a traineeship at the BBC to do news training.
Well, where was your mind at the time? Because you could have kind of rested on your laurels and sat back at the Algarve for 10, 15 years. Was that always a stepping stone in your mind? Were you always going to end up at the BBC? What was your ambition at that moment?
I must admit, I did see the very first episode of Newsnight in 1979 and went, I would love to work on that programme one day. So I did always think about TV news, and I did consume inordinate amounts of television when I was a kid. I used to sort of do my homework in front of the TV and all the rest of it. So,
and it was any kind of TV. It wasn't TV. It wasn't rolling news at that point, was it? There was the 6 and the 10. Yeah,
I was always interested in the news, but I was primarily interested in watching TV and wasted an awful lot of time doing that. So I didn't have any particular plan to get into the BBC, except my sister was a news trainee at the BBC. Actually, my wife was also a BBC trainee at the BBC, although we didn't meet until later. But what happened actually was that I was in Portugal, and the father of my great friend Paul, he was out to visit, and he gave me and he knew I was from Belfast, and he was very interested in the news, and he actually cut this article out and said, here's a story about Belfast that you should read. So I read it, and on the back, would you believe, was an advert for apply to be a news trainee at the BBC. I think it seemed like a sign to me. Anyway, I got the...
Where was the placement? Geographically, was it in
London?
It was in London, right?
Yeah. So I applied, and I went off, and I had to sort of sneak away from work in Portugal one weekend to go and do an interview in London. And
you can't fake a doctor's appointment, can you? Another flight away.
Yeah.
And then, so you clearly got on the trainee scheme, and what kind of stories were you working on?
Well, I went all right. The trainee scheme, and I'm not sure if it's still going, but it was just the best thing.
It's much reduced.
Yeah, so I think it was 8 people a year or 16 people a year. I can't remember. I think it was 8 people on my course, and it was fantastic because you got 2 years of kind of classroom training, but then you also got a chance to go around the regions and go to different newsrooms. So you went to World Service, and you went to the World at One, and you went to BBC Nottingham, and it was just absolutely fantastic. And then I ended up on Newsnight.
I asked, exactly.
So I asked for an attachment. I think it was a 3 month attachment to Newsnight, and that was just fantastic. And so I sort of arrived at Newsnight, and then I said, when I was meant to leave, I said, well, you know what? I wouldn't mind doing another attachment. Could I stay? And they said, yeah, that's fine. So I just stayed, and I stayed for 7 odd years, and then I went off to Channel 4 News.
But they were the only two shows that actually gave the guests sufficient time to answer the question properly, wasn't they? That had that gravitas and had that depth.
Yeah, look, I think those are both great, great shows. And I absolutely loved Newsnight from the first time I saw it. And I just loved their approach to the whole way that they went about doing the news, whether it was Paxman or Peter Snow. It was just a fantastic show. So,
Who was the presenting team then? when you were producer, was it Paxman and Peter Snow?
So when I first started, it was Paxman and Peter Snow and Donald McCormick on it. I think he was. Yeah.
Just slightly before my time.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Jeremy Vine was the presenter when I started watching.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that was a little bit later.
Absolutely.
Yeah, yeah. But that was good. And I became Peter Snow's producer on the Sand Pit. And on the swingometer and things like that. And pure heaven. It was just a great, great time. That was during what war was that? The first Iraq war.
Mm.
We used to do the sand pit every day to tell the story of the war. And so you were basically playing around with model soldiers and filming the sequences in the afternoon with Peter Snow jumping around. It was absolutely fantastic.
Great. How do you brief Peter on the swingometer? I mean, we're actually chatting with Jeremy next week, actually, who's now the custodian of the swingometer. But, I mean, 1992 was an amazing election, of course, because everyone thought Neil Kinnock was going to win it.
Yeah, well, it was fantastic. I mean, when I say brief Peter on the swing, you didn't really have to do any briefing. He knew it was more restraining. Peter's producer was more about restraining. Because he was fantastic. We used to go to his house. And actually, the very first time I used an Apple computer was with Peter Snow. Because there were those, you know, like, I can't remember the model number. You know, those were box-like, very early Apple computers. And we used to go off to his house and go through lots and lots of handwritten stats. He used to keep the polling information in these sort of handwritten pads. And dream up the graphics for the swingometer, etc. And it was absolutely amazing fun. But really, so he knew all the information. He knew exactly what he wanted to do. My job really was to try to get it to work in 3 minutes, or you know, keep it under control. And I remember there was one time we were doing the budget program, and the hour was approaching 6 o'clock, and we were off the air at 6 o'clock to go to the 6 o'clock news, and the producer of the program, who's a guy called David Dickinson, he kept not coming to us. So we had all these fantastic sequences planned and
waiting to go,
you know. And I was just trying to get on the air, and we just couldn't get on the air, and he just kept ignoring us. So at about 5 to 6, or 4 minutes to six, or whatever, he finally came to us and said, "Can you just sort of do a wrap up?" And Peter had so much material to say, and was so enthusiastic that he just kept going, and David Dickinson was going, Time to wrap, 30 seconds left. And Peter just kept on going. So we had the unlikely distinction of having crashed the 6 o'clock news. I mean, we finished at about 2 minutes past six. We delayed the 6 o'clock news. David was not happy.
I've always wondered how that actually works, because presumably there isn't an actual cut-off where someone in another part of the BBC HQ fades you out come what may and then says, right, we'll tee up the six. I mean, that tends to happen now with the weather. If they don't get it quite right, it just cuts off and then goes to the
music. Indeed, no, that's right. And presumably they could have just cut away from us. But for some reason, they wanted to keep the budget show going to a natural conclusion. So we managed to delay the 6 o'clock news.
So you did 7 years at Newsnight. I mean, and when you moved away, did you think that was a permanent move away, or did you think it was one of these classic BBC kind of things where you go outside the BBC for a few years to then return triumphantly as editor or director general or whatever?
Yeah. So after, really, what it was at Newsnight, I started as a trainee, and then I worked myself up to program editor. So I kind of done all the different roles on the show, and then after the 97 election, I applied to be the editor of the show, and I thought, I'd like to be the editor of Newsnight, and that would be great. But I was still quite young at that point, so I didn't succeed. So in a huff, I took myself. Well, it wasn't in a huff, but I took myself off to Channel 4 News as deputy editor there.
Were you poached, if you don't mind me asking, or did you kind of look surreptitiously? Was this another one where you had to have a 3-day dental appointment?
No. So what happened there? Gosh, I'm trying to remember. What happened was that Jim Gray, who was the deputy editor of Newsnight, was a great friend of mine, a great colleague of mine, when I was on Newsnight the first time round, he went off to be editor of Channel 4 News. And then after the election, as I remember it, I tried to be the editor at Newsnight and didn't succeed. And then I think he called me up and said, would I be interested in going to Channel 4 News? He's now, of course, back at the BBC.
He is indeed.
Yeah. So
you were there 5 years, weren't you?
Yeah. And that was, again, that was a fantastic time, because
Blair was all powerful at that point. What was the story? I suppose there was quite a few. There was oh God! There was the F1 scandal with Bernie Eccleston and all kinds of stuff, wasn't
it? Yeah, no, that's right. Because it was sort of the immediate post-election Tony Blair story, wasn't it?
As God, yeah.
What was very interesting was that we were pitching for the contract. So the Channel 4 News, I think, in those days was considered to be a little bit sort of outdated and hadn't moved with the times. So the contract was up for grabs. So we were kind of fighting to.
Who are your competitors? I've always think ITN have produced Channel 4 News.
Yeah, well, I can't remember. I think Sky and a couple of other people, I think, were in for it. But anyway, there was a right old battle to win the contract.
Wow.
And that was when we sort of reinvented the show, and that, you know, the long table and the new the studio and so on, which has been going, gosh, since 1998, I think. Yes, that's right.
So the more things change, the more they stay the same, yeah. News presentation.
So that was great. I mean, great fun, sort of reinventing and recreating the the programme. And
who was the presenting team then?
So the presenting team, well, it was Jon Snow.
It still beats John, yeah. Was Christian in there?
I think we brought Christian in, if I remember correctly.
Yeah, you did. What was it like in terms of the different culture there? Because you'd, you know, you'd been at the Luxembourg Gazette, you'd been at the BBC, you were kind of Newsnight Live at that point. You go to Channel 4 News, you're at ITN, it's completely different. You're on, presumably you were on Gray's Inn Road, were you?
On Gray's Inn Road, absolutely.
So literally, physical and culture change. Was it different?
It's really interesting. There's a very, obviously, a very distinctive BBC culture, there's a very distinctive Newsnight culture, and the ITN culture is a very interesting culture because it's very sort of lean and mean. It's sort of slim culture. It's even slimmer now than it was then. But it's a very can do, lean culture and a great kind of family. There's a sort of ITN family and a fantastic kind of can do spirit and quite emotional. Quite a lot of sort of gritty, emotional people like Dave Mannion, who said, we can do this, let's go for the top and do it. So the ITN culture was great, I enjoyed it hugely.
So clearly that was your second member of the Snow family. What was that like?
Yeah, well, there is something that links Peter Snow and Jon Snow, other than their cousins.
I always thought they were father and son, but they're actually cousins, aren't they?
They're cousins. They both have an extraordinary, boundless enthusiasm for what they do. And, I mean, Jon Snow, I don't know how many years he's now been doing it, but a huge number of years. And, he seems to bring the same enthusiasm and energy to it night after night, night after night. And again, in production terms, restraining is certainly a term that springs to mind. But now, I mean, a great period, great fun. And of course, we had 9/11, of course, during that period. And I just remember, I was actually having lunch, I remember, in an Italian restaurant around the corner from Gray's Inn Road, and we had pagers in those days. I mean, it's looking back, you don't you forget, don't you, what the technology was at the time? But we didn't have mobile phones; we had pagers, and I remember our pagers went off and said, "Come back to the office. There's been an incident at the World Trade Center," and we got back to the office just in time to see the second tower come down.
So you were watching that live on CNN or Sky or something?
Yeah, and we were kind of...
Did you know it was a second plane? A lot of people at that moment thought it might have been a replay of the first plane.
That was precisely what we thought it was. So we came into the office and sort of huddled around the news desk watching what was going on. And, the second plane went in live and we were kind of having this debate amongst ourselves saying it's a replay. It was total confusion. Mm. And then within a very few minutes, we were on the air trying to make sense of it and just sort of doing rolling news and just looking at the live pictures. All was chaos and trying to explain what was going on and put together some sort of sensible commentary about it.
But was there an emotional challenge at that moment? Because, we speak to some journalists sometimes on these podcasts, and like with the death of Diana, do you remember Martin Lewis was very famously, very visibly moved on air? Do you think that was a challenge? Or on those kind of crises moments, is it, right, total focus, you're in the zone, professionalism, let's get the news out?
Well, look, it was a massive, massive story. And I think the biggest challenge is just to try to compute what's going on and kind of instantly put it in some sort of context. So you here we are, 2015, and what happened then still informs this era. It's such a big part of this era. But when something like that happens, you've got to try to tell the immediate story, and there's so many different strands of the story. But you've also got to very, very quickly try to put the whole thing in context and get a sense of how important it is in the sweep of history. So I mean, we had that, and then we had 7/7. I remember I was back at Newsnight on 7/7, and again, that was always chaos that day because we just had the 10th anniversary of it. But it was that situation where the events happened, and your primary thing is are all our staff, have they made it to the office? And I remember in the first, there was the first sort of inklings of it, and we were going, PowerSurge, and what is it? And I think it was actually, I think he even officially said that it was a PowerSurge right at the beginning. So there was a huge amount of confusion. And then, of course, you're worried about your own staff. Have they made it to the office, and where are they, and all of that? And then you've got to try to work out how you get something on the air at 10:30 that evening. So those days are absolutely astonishing. Incredible.
Just going back briefly to your time at Channel 4 News, because in terms of Newsnight and Channel 4 News, they were slightly more contemplative, giving that extra space for that extra insight. Was there a challenge when these kind of rolling events were happened where you had to kind of mimic the kind of immediacy of Sky and News Channel?
Yeah, well, I mean, like, that's always we always had the rule at Newsnight, which was, you know, you should be able to respond to the circumstances, whatever is going on. So, you know, and the point about Newsnight is that you could literally be doing live rolling news, or you could be doing a 1 hour pre-prepared debate program. The format can take everything in between. So we didn't go to rolling news live very often. But I remember the Pope died, for example. Mm. I can't remember which Pope it was, one of the Popes died. I remember we basically became 24-hour news or rolling news for that window. So it was, and getting that right, because obviously the point about you know, news, rolling news or news channels is it's a machine that is set up to do that kind of programming day in, day out. But taking a machine that isn't set up to do it every day is a challenge. And, you know, we had some screw-ups sometimes.
How often did you have to throw out the pre-prepared scripts? I mean, we had John Humphreys on a few weeks ago, and he was it was the day that Charlie Kennedy's death had been announced. And he said that they'd had a whole programme prepared by the overnight team, everything was good to go. And then on air, as Corey Caulfield was literally reading out the news at 6:02 a.m, his family announced that Charlie Kennedy had died, and they literally just scrapped the whole programme, and the producers were teeing up interviewees and then saying, right, John, you've got Paddy Ashdown in 7 seconds, over to you. And of course, clearly, no one really knew anything. Yeah. I mean, was there a lot of challenging times like that?
Yeah, I mean, look, quite rare that you would chuck the whole programme out, but certainly there were occasions where you know at 4 o'clock in the afternoon some huge thing happened and you would just start again. But we had a rule of thumb that said you should be able to, you have a formula in which you should be able to respond adequately to whatever happens, given the amount of time that you have to respond to it. So, you know, if something happens immediately, you go live and you ad lib and you say, I'm reading some wire copy and this is what's happened. If you've got half an hour, you maybe throw together some pictures. If you've got 3 hours, you have analysis and you make a little film around it. So it should always be possible, given the amount of time that you've got, to do something cleanly and sensible. That's the theory. Yeah, but of course, sometimes you fell off the air and all kinds of calamity. By the way, that's something that viewers loved as well.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, viewers love it when things go wrong and when there's a bit of chaos.
Kind of odd timing question here is, you know, did you have to break fewer stories live on Newsnight? Because clearly, you know, when Channel 4 was on air at 7 o'clock, stuff can still happen at 7, can't it? Whereas did less stuff happen, if I can put it that inarticulately, on the kind of the half 10 time? I mean, things have already been done and dusted there, haven't they?
Yeah, I mean, look, in general terms, I mean, we didn't do much breaking news or live news, and the point really about Newsnight was to make sense of the world and you know, bring analysis to it and do longer form films and longer form interviews and so on. So, yeah, and the day tended to be settled by, you know, a certain point in the afternoon, and you could then aim to say something sensible about it. Yeah.
So, just going back to your career, you'd done 5 years at Channel 4 News. Then how did Tonight with Trevor McDonald come calling? Was that because I imagine that's because it's still ITN, isn't it? Was that classed as an internal poaching or what?
No, it's not ITN. It was ITV. It was made by Granada. Tonight with Trevor McDonald was a fantastic experience. I only went for 1 year, but it was one of the great, great years of my career, and I enjoyed it thoroughly. So what happened was I was at Channel 4 News, and I kept noticing that this program, Tonight with Trevor McDonald, of which I hadn't paid a huge amount of attention before, was breaking some really, really good stories.
It was a great program, and he's a great anchor.
Yeah, and it was doing some great stuff. And the guy who was doing it was James Goldstone, now president of ABC News, who I'd known a little bit from the BBC, and he had become the editor of Tonight with Trevor McDonald, and he was very, very ambitious, just to smash it up and do some great stuff. And I was chatting with him one day, and I just sort of said, look, I really like what you're doing. You're doing some great stuff. He said, well, let's go and have lunch. So we went and had lunch. And I then ended up on as deputy editor on Tonight with Trevor McDonald. And it was just an incredible sort of smash and grab year of doing the most amazing programmes.
And it was on weekly, wasn't it?
It was on weekly.
Was it 26 weeks of the year? How was the actual scheduling?
I can't remember exactly, but I think it may have been more than that. But it was a weekly show,
and it was quite a lot of output to put out.
It was an extraordinary rollercoaster. And then we did, you know, we had the Michael Jackson, Living with Michael Jackson,
Martin Bashir, very famously.
Martin Bashir, yeah. And that got an audience of 15 million. Imagine an audience of 15 million. And I always remember Steve Anderson, who was the director of programs, he said, look, enjoy the moment because you're never going to get an audience bigger than 15 million ever again in your career.
Mm.
And a month later, we got 16 million. And can you remember what the show was?
Oh, no, I can't really. No, actually.
It was the coughing major. It was the Who Wants to Be a Millionaire coughing major.
Oh, of course.
And that was absolutely fantastic because Steve Anderson came into the office one day and said, I've got a great story for you.
Because you went in quite strong with that and said he was a wrong un in the programme, didn't you? He didn't say...
Oh, well, I can't remember if it had gone to trial yet.
No, it hadn't gone to trial.
Of course it hadn't.
But you played the clips where he was clearly coughing at the right moment.
So they had all the material and they said, look, we've got all this material. We've got all the raw footage from the show and then over to you and you can just do with it what you will. And I can't remember how long the show was, but it was probably an hour or more.
And you had Chris Tarrant on it as an interviewee, didn't you?
Yeah. We kind of just ran the whole thing in real time, ran the whole quiz show with all the coughing moments and all the questions, and then stopped the action from time to time and had Chris Tarrant and the sound engineer and various people talking about it. And it was electrifying stuff, and it got 16 million viewers. It was incredible.
But you were only there a year, weren't you? Because then the BBC came calling back. How did that work? Did they re-poach you?
What happened was that I'd been there for a year, and then Peter Horrocks, who was editor of Newsnight when I was there first time round, or for the second half of my period the first time round, he called me up and said, "We're doing this new show, or we want to do a new show on BBC Current Affairs, which is about analysis of interesting topics of our time. So we want to do a sort of an analysis show."
And this would be a standalone show. It wasn't a kind of strand within Newsnight.
No, this wasn't within Newsnight. The idea was that this would be a weekly show or a monthly show. It wasn't clear, but basically what the idea was, could we analyze issues that are not necessarily televisual? So, for example, what was said was the pensions crisis. Can we do a show that explains the pensions crisis or the energy crisis? Or the growing obesity crisis, whatever it was.
But without recourse to kind of Peter or Jeremy with a big load of graphics on a blue screen kind of setup,
they just said, look, can you kind of dream up a show that analyses these important issues of our age? So that was what became a show called If, and the idea behind If was it was effectively drama documentaries looking into the future. And there was definitely a millennial thing going on, because everybody was thinking about the future and what's going to happen in the next millennium, and it took us ages to work out what we were trying to do, but the format that we came up with was we see documentaries and sometimes drama documentaries that tell us about the past, and you have the action, you have the footage, and you maybe have some dramatizations. And then you have interviews talking about those happenings in the past or events in the past. So why can't we do the same kind of format looking at the future? And that's what we did. And kind of when we cracked that format, then it all fell into place. So that was If, and we did.
So you were dramatizing the future then?
We were trying to dramatize
the future. And hoverboards
let me just say,
what?
I think that was the hardest thing I've ever done. I remember...
Were there any hoverboards? That's all I need to know.
It was terribly, terribly, terribly... I hadn't done any drama before, and it was very, very difficult. And I remember having a drink with my wife one night and just saying, I'm not at all sure that this is going to work. And a significant amount of money had been invested in this series, and they were sort of preparing the schedules. And
presumably had some people on the production team that were experienced in drama and putting on these kind of dramatisations.
Yes, I mean, we kind of put together a little bit of a ragtag army of people, some of whom had experience in drama and some of whom had experience in Current Affairs, and kind of meshed it all together and made these programs. And I was very pleased with it. There was the first one in particular, which was called If the Lights Go Out, was about the energy, the looming energy crisis and the dependence on imported Russian gas and the move to renewable energy and so on. And to be honest, you this story, you see it played out.
Still a
massive worry. It was in the news in the last few days. And this was a story which kind of demonstrated a vision of how Britain might run out of energy in the coming years. And we dramatised it, and somehow it kind of hung together and worked. It was very good fun.
How many episodes did that run for? I must admit.
Well, it ran for two series. So was it six shows in the first series? There's six shows in the first series. It had things like, you know, the growing inequality gap, and it had the pensions crisis.
Was it BBC One?
BBC Two, yeah. I think it was. It was BBC Two, and it got more than 2 million viewers, which was, again...
It passed me by, unfortunately.
Well, you should look it up.
I will Google
look,
that.
Yeah. If the Lights Go Out was the one that I think was the most successful, and I think it got 3.5 million viewers for the first episode, and it was great.
But then you did two seasons, and then was
there... Well, I did one season, and then it lasted for two seasons, but I then went back to Newsnight. And at that point... I remember, I think it was George Entwistle said to me, because he was editor of Newsnight, and he said, would you consider going back to Newsnight? And I kind of said, well, probably that moment has passed. And then maybe a month later, he then went off to do, I can't remember, was he doing the Culture Show, I think it was, or something, something like that. And Peter Horrocks rang me up and said, well, would you come back and do Newsnight? And I just kind of knew in an instant that that was what I wanted to do. So I went and did... did Newsnight for 4 years. That was great.
Did you play hard to get at first, or did they know you desperately wanted it?
I applied for it. I had to apply for it, and it was one of those moments where I hadn't, in a sort of conversation a month earlier, would I like to edit Newsnight? I'd sort of said, nah, I'm not sure I would. And then the moment that it was on offer, I said, of course, I've got to go and do that.
How did you feel at that moment then, walking back onto the set in the production office, as it were? Because, you know, you'd always dreamed of working at Newsnight, as well, and there you are returning as editor. I mean, that must have been a pretty good personal moment for you.
From my point of view, that was absolutely fantastic, because that was the thing I'd always wanted to do ever since I first saw the show. And editing Newsnight for me was really the most exciting thing, and it was an incredible challenge. It was incredibly hard work. You know, you're sort of, you know, or stayed to watch the show until midnight, you know, five nights a week or four or five nights a week. So it was pretty full on, but it was an extraordinary, fascinating and enjoyable time. Great.
Where did you watch the show physically? I mean, East Lake Broadcasting House at that point. Are you in the gallery, or do you go home and then kind of think, well, leave it to the on-air team now?
So we were at White City, so we were at TV Centre. I would stay and watch it live about three nights a week, and then two nights a week I would drift off home at about 7 o'clock and watch it at home. But nevertheless, you were still watching it until 11:15 at night, and then ringing the programme editor to have some thoughts about whether it was good or bad.
So that debrief took place immediately after the show went to air, as it were.
Yeah, yeah. So you would have a little, you know, if you were there in person, you'd all go back to the office and have a little debrief and just sort of stand around in a huddle and say, well, what was good and what was less good and so on.
I mean, clearly you made some changes as well and some innovations, like the daily email and all this kind of thing. I mean, did you get any resistance internally from the team? I know Jeremy Paxman famously didn't really like all these kind of things. And I know Jeremy Vine in his book, It's All News to Me, kind of said there was some tensions on the show.
Nah, look, it was all great fun, I think. And Jeremy... played it for laughs. I mean, he's a fantastic, fantastic character. And I think he knew exactly what he was doing in that he had this kind of ongoing soap opera, really, around his supposed resistance to the internet and new technology. But I mean, the great thing about that period was that it was, you know, it was 2004 to 2008. And I particularly remember around 2006, you know, literally there was a new thing called, I don't know, Facebook or YouTube or Twitter every single week. It was just an incredibly exciting time. And we would literally come into the... Well, see, it was interesting because even though the internet had been going for quite a long time by that stage, it wasn't terribly far advanced at Newsnight, for example. So I remember the first day I came in as editor at Newsnight, and I sort of said, so where's the web team? And they said, well, we don't have a web team. and not that there was a very advanced web team on Channel 4 News. I mean, we sort of sat down.
There were people in chairs.
There was a small, very, very small number of people. I mean, we launched the Channel 4 News website. We literally bought front page off the... We bought it in a shop. We went along to a shop and bought the software that was called Front Page, which you probably don't remember.
Microsoft Front Page. No, I use that for my sins.
And we brought Front Page back to the office, and we sort of worked out how to create a website, and that became the Channel 4 News website.
Which was created in Microsoft Front Page. Incredible.
It was created in Front Page, and it was a guy called Peter Wilson, and he kind of read the instructions and chewed a pencil for a couple of days and then said, right, I think I'll sort of crack this. So that's what we did. And then at Newsnight, I sort of went in, and that was 2004, 11 years ago.
You would have expected them to
have
a web team.
And you would thought there might have been a web team. But actually what there was a director who was quite web savvy and interested in it, a guy called Peter Day. And he, if he was directing the show that day, he would be in the office. And if he was in the office, he would update the website. And if he was not in the office, it didn't get updated.
Right.
So I sort of said, I went across to two chaps and said, so what are you doing today? And they went, well, we're working on a film, or we're putting together a piece. And I kind of went, not anymore. You're not the web team. And they became the web team, and they were absolutely fantastic. And they did it for a long, long time. I think actually maybe they're still doing it,
or
maybe one of them, maybe one of them not. But they did a great, great job, and we just had a ball, because, as I say, these new platforms and services and tools were just becoming available on a weekly basis. And we used to literally go in every week and say, right, what's new this week, and what can we play around with, whether it was YouTube or vodcasts or podcasts or whatever it was. It was great fun.
On the kind of pie chart of your time at this point, what proportion was getting the show out and editing, and what proportion was kind of internal BBC politics? Did you have to dedicate 10-15% of your time to your managerial meetings and all that kind of thing, or were you kind of just kind of left to get on with it?
Well, a little bit of both, I suppose. I mean, there's always a lot of meetings at the BBC, and you had to do that. And always sort of manage the number of meetings that you would go to, but Newsnight was very, had a sort of independent bent, and we had a lot of freedom to do the programmes we wanted to do. And as I say, you could literally do a one item show, or you could do five items. You could do whatever you liked within that window of the time you had. So I spent most of my time thinking about what was on the show, and I spent increasing amounts of time thinking about the web and what we could do there, and the aim being to join the two things up. And, I think Jeremy sort of famously made some barbed comments and so on, but that kind of added to the fun of it, and the kind of, it was a little bit like Morecambe and Wise, telling the stories about how mean their producer was. It was kind of a little bit of an ongoing soap opera, and I suppose it was an early form of viral marketing, really. I remember the time we did a project called Oh My Newsnight, which was about user-generated content. And this was not long after 7/7 and the Bunsfield fire, when the BBC noticed that people were sending in their material for the first time. And what happened was that we said, well, look, there's this new thing called YouTube. Wouldn't it be good if we could persuade people to create their own films about current affairs issues, and they will then send them to us and we'll put them on the air? And Jeremy did a very kind of scathing little promo video for this. And then one night at the end of the show, he did a sort of call out for it. Because no one would send anything to us. So it was kind of too early. So we were sort of promoting it like crazy and getting literally nothing in. The inbox was completely empty, so there was nothing at all. And then eventually one night he went on he did the payoff to the show, saying, you can see it all again on the website along with our editor's pathetic pleas for you to send us your old bits of home.
I saw that live. Or maybe I didn't, and I've just seen it on YouTube, but I've definitely seen it.
It's definitely on YouTube. And anyway, that all became quite a thing, and it was on the front page of the Daily Telegraph.
Absolutely.
And then, of course, the whole thing took off, and we got lots
great
of films.
Great PR,
films,
frankly.
Yeah, great. Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So, tragedy and kind of explosions and all these kind of things aside, what was a typical day like on Newsnight? I mean, what time did you get into White City? Was it, what time was conference? How did it work? How did you put a show together?
Gosh, you're testing my memory here. But I would listen. See, I always used to listen. I still do it, to be honest. Listen to World Service the whole way through the night. Not awake all the time, but I would just always leave.
It's just on
World Service Radio.
I do Wake Up to Money and Morning Reports 5 Live. That starts my day.
Yeah.
Pre-today.
So I typically would just listen to the World Service. And the slightly embarrassing thing would be when you get to the office and say, have you heard that great story? And unfortunately, it was a dream rather than actually was on the radio. But anyway, so you've... I always listen to World Service and then the Today programme. after that. And then I would phone them at 9 o'clock. There was a cross BBC meeting at 9:15. So I would usually phone at 9 o'clock and say, "What are you thinking about for today?" And we'd have a chat and, you know, kick around some suggestions. And then I think the first team meeting, 10 a.m. or 10:30. I can't quite remember.
But ridiculously early.
Yeah, maybe 10:30. I think. And then off you would go. And then I think there was a sort of technical catch-up meeting. Ooh, what time? 5:30 or 6:30, something like that. And then you would put it all together and off you go at 10:30 at night.
And did you have a kind of formula in your mind? Last question on this, because like you look at Rolling News now, and you look at say Live at Five, and you can there's always going to be three guests. You know, one down the line, two in the studio, preferably four packages and the Rolling stuff. Did you have a kind of ingredients list for everything? Well, where you think we're going to do three topics?
Not exactly. Sometimes you could do a special show where you maybe had an audience and you had a debate, that kind of thing. But sometimes you do three or four or five items. But I think there was a kind of shape, and I think it's kind of important that you have the audience knows roughly what to expect, and you have some signposting within the show and maybe some repeating formats and things like that. So I suppose you're right that there was a toolkit of things that you could do. It was a very, very flexible toolkit, because it wasn't like the news where you might have 10 or 11 2-minute news items, which were pretty regimented. You had a huge amount of freedom, but within that you had recognisable sort of clubs to play.
One of the things that struck me when I read John Major's autobiography is that when he went into becoming Prime Minister, he already had an exit plan in his mind. And there's you as editor of Newsnight. Did you have a kind of similar thing where you thought, I'm going to do this for 5 years and then go for DG? Because in a sense, you'd reached your top job. I find it very interesting, the psychology of people when they get to that, the top of their mountain, what they do next. And he already had an eye on the next mountain.
Yeah, well, I didn't really have an exit plan, but I did, and my wife reminds me of this from time to time, we did have a sort of agreement, which was that I would do it for a certain period and then stop doing it. And I think the period in mentioned was 2.5 years. So,
and then what was the plan then? Were you going to sell ice creams on Brighton Beach?
That wasn't quite clear. Yeah. I ended up doing it for 4 years, and I didn't have a particular plan in mind for what I would do after Newsnight, except, as I say, I became more and more interested in new media and technology. So I suppose at a certain point I went, well, look, I need to move on from Newsnight at some point reasonably soon, not least because my wife is encouraging me to do so. And I did.
Just so you could have a life.
I did promise that. And yeah, of course. Look, I mean, the point is, it's hard, I think, to do a show that finishes at 11:15 at night, 5 nights a week for a long and sustained period.
So, and then the debrief, and then, listening to the World Service overnight as well.
Yeah, possibly having a glass of wine, you know. After 4 years, I was kind of thinking, what should I do next? I was interested in technology and new media.
But were you looking, if you don't mind me asking, were you looking internally within the BBC, or was it just looking all over?
No, I was in a bit of both. I was kind of thinking, well, maybe there's something in this area within the BBC, and maybe there's something elsewhere.
And so how did the move to Google come?
Well, I was having a look around.
How big were they then? They must have been earth-shatteringly large even then.
Well, I don't think. I'm trying to remember how many employees there were. Cause there's a thing at Google which is, if you type your name into the internal system, you can see what percentage of the Google population joined after you. And I think the last time I looked, it was 87%. So I'm in the first 13%. Of Google employees. I can't remember how many were in London in those days, but it might have been a few hundred.
But they were clearly going for some heavy hitters. I mean, there's the editor of Newsnight being poached to run the comms and PR and public affairs operation. I mean, that's a pretty hefty hire from their point of view.
Well, it was, I suppose, Google was then and still is very, very young. It's an engineering company. It's a computer science company. Which had sort of come on the scene very, very quickly. And, you know, I think one of the issues that Google has faced over the years is that it doesn't necessarily have roots or relationships with the rest of the media or with other organisations or businesses. So at that point, understanding better the media scene was certainly something that was a priority for Google, and that's how I came along at the right moment.
Do you think that newness to the industry, as it were, is a blessing or a curse, or a kind of bit of both?
Well, it's definitely a bit of both. I mean, look, what Google was able to do over the years was clearly come up with lots of great new products and innovations and to move really fast. On the downside, we didn't necessarily have relationships with, for example, the news industry. And of course, what was happening and continues to happen is that the pace of change in the digital revolution causes disruption. So, that's something that we have learned to get better at over the years.
Do you think a lot of the media players just kind of lazily perceive you as a threat? They don't innovate and take advantage of the platform you provide.
If you look at
Google News, you know the money you put in and the change. Do you think they're just not agile enough?
I think it's really hard. I mean, if you look at new established news organisations, I mean, you know this well. What we've been talking about it, getting the programme or getting the newspaper out every day is a challenge, and you build a machine that enables you to do that every day, and that machine by and large runs extremely well. But thinking about changing that machine, I mean, people have said it's like rebuilding a jumbo jet in the air. That's the problem, isn't it? So thinking ahead strategically, it's much easier if you were to start from scratch and say, right, we've got all these amazing tools at our disposal. We can shoot films on our phone that 10 years ago would have cost a fortune, and we can broadcast what we do to the world for free. Those are fantastic tools for journalism. So the tools at the disposal of journalists these days are incredible and better than they've ever been. But if you've got the infrastructure of an established news organisation on the staff, and you've got the printing costs and all of the rest of it, making the changes in an agile way is very, very,
very difficult. Challenging.
So that's something that we've been working really hard with the news industry over recent years to be helpful in that transition. And you may have seen something that we launched recently called the Digital News Initiative,
which
is working with a range of publishers across Europe expressly to address those issues, whether it's on the product development side, or can Google work with publishers in the way that it develops its products for news that are helpful to the long-term future of the news industry and of high quality journalism. Can we be helpful with training? Can we be helpful with innovation funding? So that's something that we're working very hard on at the moment.
What was your to-do list when you joined Google? And I'm also fascinated as to who wrote your to-do list, because I have a couple of American clients, and to their credit, they let me set the to-do list and get on with it. They say, you're the expert in this area of the world, in that media, get on with it. I mean, given your seniority, were you kind of just put in place to say, right, you're going to then decide what you need to do and what needs to get done? Or did they have a few strategic objectives that they wanted you to kind of shepherd and manage?
Yeah,
I imagine it'll be both.
Yeah, again, a bit of both. But the general way of working at Google is... It's a very interesting way of working, which is that you are given a lot of freedom and autonomy to try things and come up with your own plan. So what Google does famously is that it measures everything, and it sets your we call them OKRs, objectives and key results, which is the same as KPIs somewhere else. But you set your objectives in consultation with your manager. And then you're very rigorously measured against those targets. So did you hit the things that you said you were going to do? But in terms of formulating your plan or your strategy, there's a lot of experimentation and a lot of freedom. So when I joined in 2008, we were just 10 years old. So we weren't absolutely the new kid on the block. We had grown up a little bit, but nevertheless, we were still very young. And actually, our presence in Europe was still very early days. And looking back, people used to talk about it. It's a little bit like drinking water from a fire hydrant. It was that kind of. There's so much interest and so much incoming inquiries and so on.
There's a challenge just to get on top of it.
Just to get on top of it. So I think, if I look back on my 7 years now at Google, quite a lot of that period was just p- putting in place the kind of organizational blocks to make sense of the work that, that you're trying to do, and to try to simplify processes. I mean, the way that it works at Google, obviously, there's a huge amount of information flying around, there's a huge amount of email, and the danger is you can end up with everybody doing everything. So trying to organize yourselves and trying to work out what it is that you're trying to achieve and simplify your targets and fewer, bigger, better, which is, to borrow a phrase from the BBC, certainly that was quite a challenge in the early years.
I mean, now Google's getting to the point where, and has been for a few years, where the European Commission, for example, are stepping in to try and, you know, impose this right to be forgotten legislation and so on. And part of me, you know, feels sorry for Google, because you clearly have to adhere to the law and uphold it. But on the other hand, I can see the reasons why you object to it. But do you think there's an element of, do you remember when the European Commission were attacking Microsoft for kind of dominating it with Internet Explorer, where it seems incredibly important at the time, but years later you look back, I mean, Microsoft have just dumped Internet Explorer now for commercial reasons and not for any regulatory thing. Do you think there is a challenge there in terms of Google having a positive relationship with regulators? Because clearly you're going to have to uphold laws you don't believe in.
Yeah, well, look, I mean,
and I think there's a strong argument to be made that the legislation is flawed as well.
Well, if you think about what we're trying to do as a company, we're trying to build products that can have a positive impact on as many people around the world as possible. That's the entire sort of raison d'etre of Google, is to organize the world's information and make it universally accessible and helpful. So that's what we're starting to do. We moved very fast in our early years, and we continue to move fast, and we continue to innovate. But I think probably looking back on it, you know, coming from America, not necessarily appreciating the different cultures, the different attitude to privacy, for example, that exists in Europe. So we kind of learned that the hard way, but you know, whether it was the Wi-Fi data issue relating to Street View or whatever it was. But you know, we made a few mistakes along the way. But if you go back then to the right to be forgotten, really we acknowledge that the way that things work in Europe mean that we are scrutinized by the authorities. We need to follow the regulations, and you know, I think we, as Larry Page said at the time, we need to listen more and take part in the debate. These are kind of important issues and debates of our time, and it's not, you know, it'd be most peculiar, wouldn't it, if with all the change that has happened in a very, very short period of time, really literally 15, 20 years, if all the issues that have been thrown up by that change were neatly packaged and all sorted out. Of course they're not all sorted out. So our responsibility is to engage with them and respond to the challenges that are put in front of us. But the way that we fundamentally think about things is what is best for the user. So the entire focus of all the work we do is, can we build products that are helpful to people and helpful on a global scale? And if we get that right, then the revenue and so on will flow from that. So that remains the laser-like focus. But of course, it leads to scrutiny, it leads to questions, it leads to debates about all the issues that you'd read about in the papers every day. And we're absolutely committed to taking part in those debates and doing the right thing. So I mean, if you look at the right to be forgotten, what we did there was we said, look, we it wasn't a welcome piece of legislation from our point of view, and we had concerns about it, but we knuckled down to complying with it in the best way that we could, and there wasn't a huge amount of information made available by the ruling. It was remove information that is irrelevant or out of date. So where do you draw the lines? How do you draw up a criteria for dealing with that? So we had a kind of roadshow of a listening exercise, what we called an advisory council, and we met in seven cities across Europe, and we asked experts, whether privacy experts or free expression experts, to come in and give us their thoughts and advise us, and that then fed into our processes. And of course, the whole way through, we consulted very closely with the data protection authorities in Europe, and I think by and large, if you look across the board, the data protection authorities and most of the experts in the area would say that we had responded to the right to be forgotten in a very conscientious and responsible way.
By all means, don't answer this if you don't think it's appropriate, but do you think, in a sense, from the regulator's point of view even, that the actual legislation has backfired? So I have a family member that was looking for a plumber last week, and they Googled the name of someone, and they said, well, I'm not going to hire them because it said at the bottom that there was some search results omitted, so God knows what they've been up to.
Oh,
and
dear.
I actually said, well, that could be another person with a similar name. That's
well, indeed. I'm glad you asked me that, because it's worth just pointing out what we did. If you sometimes when you search for a name, if you search for your own name or search for my name, you might see a little notification at the bottom of the page saying results could have been removed under European law. Now, the reason that we've done that is because clearly if we did a notification every time a result had been removed and didn't when one hadn't been removed, then that would identify the person.
So is it a randomised notification?
It's not randomised, but what it is it puts the notification up when you're searching for a name. So it's kind of a blanket notification intended to show that... If you're searching for a name, it is possible that results have been removed. So your plumber almost certainly didn't have a result relating to the plumber removed. It's a kind of blanket notification just because we're concerned about preserving people's privacy. So we wouldn't want to identify someone who had a result for their name removed. Maybe it's worth saying a word about the right to be forgotten.
Please do, yeah.
Because there's an awful lot of misunderstanding about it. The point about the right to be forgotten is it's applied on name searches. So if you search for Paul Blanchard... And
who is it that said, if you ever Google yourself, it's like walking into a room where everyone hates you. Have you ever heard that?
the point of it is it's based on the name. So if you've made a request under the right to be forgotten and you've had, say, a derogatory story or a story that refers to some incident from your deep past, if that's been removed under the right to be forgotten, it doesn't mean the story has been removed. That story would still exist on the BBC or the Guardian
or whatever. Yeah,
whatever. It just wouldn't appear on a search for your name.
On google.co.uk and in the European ones, but it'd still be on google.com, wouldn't it, and some of the other...
It still appears on google.com, that's right.
Final question. You obviously quite senior already within the Google's European management team. What's next for you personally? Is it a promotion, do you think, potentially within Google? I mean, I appreciate this is a personal question, or do you think you might go back to the BBC when Tony Hall decides to hang up his flogs, as it were?
To be honest, I don't really know. I haven't made any grand plans for what's next.
It's a ridiculous question, really, isn't it? Because you can't say, actually, I'm going to be DG.
It's hard to tell. But I certainly never imagined I would stay at Google for 7 years. And I must say, it has been the most interesting and invigorating ride of my career, not least because I didn't really understand what I was letting myself in for when I went to Google. And then so much changes. And every time you think that you've got to grips with one issue, then new things open up and new products happen all the time, and whole new areas of activity like driverless cars, etc. Who would have thought that we'd be doing those things going back a few years? So it remains incredibly interesting and kind of refreshing. So I haven't given a huge amount of thought to what I might do next, except I do have a kind of hankering urge at some point towards the end of my career to go back to the Algarve News. So I'm kind of... without being unkind to Luxembourg, I probably don't want to go back to Luxembourg News Digest, but I'm a huge lover of Spain, and we're actually trying to buy a house in Spain at the moment. Not to go and retire or live there all the time, but just to spend a bit more time there. But I do have one kind of target in mind, which is to go and spend a year in Spain at some point while I've still got my faculties. So that's probably as close as it gets to my near-term ambition.
Is it more frenetic working for Google than it was, say, at the Beeb? Because, when you're editor of Newsnight, stuff is happening and you've got to cover it and make sure the packages are there. But with Google, you've got all the external stuff, but then you've got, as you briefly mentioned, you've got all the stuff that's going on internally, new products, driverless cars. I'm in favour of driverless cars, by the way. I can't wait to sit back and have the car drive and also avoid the traffic jam, which I hope the car will know is an hour ahead and therefore does a detour. But, so you've kind of got two pipes of activity coming at you constantly.
Yeah, look, I would say both are pretty full-on occupations. Full-on in different ways, in the sense that, Newsnight, lots of adrenaline flowing every day, and obviously late nights as well. So, you know, it was a very, very busy machine every single day in life, although, you know, the weekends were pretty quiet. And also, you know, when you've done a program, it's gone and you move on to the next one. With Google, there's obviously a huge amount flying around all the time. If we're not the most written about company on earth, we're certainly way up there. So there's plenty of activity all the time, but it's probably not as adrenaline fueled day in, day out, because, you know, obviously we sometimes have crises and we sometimes have things where we have to, everybody has to jump almost in a newsroom type of environment. But more generally, it's slightly more predictable. We talk a lot about at Google about being uncomfortably excited. That's the kind of phrase that comes from Larry Page about the work we're doing. So it's fast moving. There's always a lot going on, but it doesn't have late evenings and it doesn't have that sort of pace that happens day in, day out in news.
Well, Peter, I think we're running out of metaphorical tape here, so it just remains for me to thank you for your time today. I've learned a huge amount, and it's been very, very enjoyable. Thank you.
Thank you very much indeed, Paul.
A Big Things Media production. Big Things!